The discussion of new strategies and trials of metastatic disease shifted to the anti-VEGF agent bevacizumab, and Dr. Sledge began by reviewing the data he presented at the ASCO meeting from the Excalibur study, a phase 2 evaluation of capecitabine and bevacizumab as first-line therapy in metastatic disease, which suggested much greater efficacy in patients with ER-positive tumors and little or no effect in patients with ER-negative tumors.
I mean, I look at capecitabine and bevacizumab and say we have a trial that is negative phase 3 trial in the refractory setting for progression-free survival, and we have a frontline trial, albeit not a phase 3 trial, that's given us distinctly miserable results, and particularly in a major subset of steroid receptor negative breast cancer patients. I guess I would throw it back to the rest of you in the room as to why you really think this would be a good combination.
Do you think capecitabine was something you would have offered? Knowing the data you know now, if this was your patient, would you have given her best treatment to be single-agent capecitabine?
If you're using capecitabine by itself, where does it fit in your algorithm now?
This is a patient who easily would have fit into E2100, so I would have offered this patient paclitaxel plus bevacizumab.
So I guess what I'm asking is, does the data from that Excalibur trial make you think that, because there's a number of studies out there right now with capecitabine and VEGF inhibitors focused on the triple-negative population. So does the triple negative part is what sways you against utilizing capecitabine here, or just because you'd rather do the paclitaxel bevacizumab?
I'm a big fan of capecitabine.
Sure.
I use a lot of it in my clinic.
But I mean, so I'm asking, in this subset, are you thinking now not for triple negatives?
I don't see any data that supports the use of this combination.
But see, even single agent, I'm just saying, does that data make you think that capecitabine in triple negatives is not maybe the best
drug? I don't know the answer to that. Okay. I would love to know the answer. I'd hope there's enough patients out there in some study that's already been done that would allow us to look at that.
Andy, I'm curious what your thoughts are about which chemotherapeutic agents you feel are reasonable to combine with bevacizumab in a non-protocol setting.
You know, my clinical practice generally follows the highest level evidence-based medicine. So when I do give bevacizumab, the vast majority of patients combine it with paclitaxel. I think there are certain unique circumstances where when paclitaxel is not appropriate, I find the occasion to combine it with other agents. Capecitabine would be the next most common, probably vinorelbine and gemcitabine. I don't think I've ever given an anthracycline and bevacizumab for metastatic disease. I would say primarily it's taxane-based therapy, though.
Skip, how would you answer that question? What about docetaxel bevacizumab?
And we've actively accrued to the Ribbon trial, so we've had a little experience with all of them, and I don't notice a marked difference in terms of toxicity. So I've done some docetaxel, paclitaxel, and some capecitabine. But, you know, I've not seen the subgroup analysis until George just presented. I mean, that certainly was that wasn't a close call. That's a big difference in terms of the results in the ER positives and negatives. It's just one trial, but, you know, we always hear about the epithelial subset of triple negatives, and you kind of think maybe that might be a place where anti-metabolites might have a role, and this certainly turns that upside down.
On the flip side, does it make you more likely to consider it with ER-positive patients?
Yes, I think so.
Frankie, can you talk a little bit how you approach the decision of first chemotherapy, and whether the patient's triple negative or the patient's already going through hormonal therapy? How do you sort out the decision about which chemotherapeutic agent or agents and where to bring in bevacizumab? Do you start out thinking, okay, well, bevacizumab is going to be the base, now I'm going to figure out what I'm going to add to that, or vice versa?
Just like Skip and most of the people around the table, it's the same way that all of us, I guess, approach the disease. What is the patient's symptom burden? What is her wish? I have patients that beg me never to take them off capecitabine, even though their circulating tumor cells are going up, because quality of life is so important. So the burden of the disease, the wishes of the patient in terms of how much toxicity they're willing to bear versus I'm young, I have two kids, you do everything you can to get me through this. So that's a major issue. In terms of using bevacizumab, most of my patients have been taxane exposed, and I try, if I can, to give nab-paclitaxel, although the economic cost of that is outrageous. I have used the capecitabine, and I guess I hadn't carefully pondered those Excalibur results, so I guess I do have some circumspection, but we are participating in the Ribbon trial, so we have enrolled patients in every cohort, the anthracycline, the taxane, and the capecitabine cohort.
Melody, could you dissect out a little bit how you approach this same decision and where bevacizumab fits in?
If the patient isn't in trouble physiologically, like lymphangitic spread or massive liver mets, I just, in the past, have tended to do what was the simplest, which would be capecitabine. But since the E2100, I am impressed with that very long improvement in progression-free survival. And so I will tend toward doing a weekly taxane with Bev if it's appropriate, if it's been more than a year since the patient's had an adjuvant taxane. And the taxane that I will use, if their insurance will cover it, would be nab-paclitaxel because I think it's better tolerated.
Nab with bevacizumab?
Mm-hmm.
Lee, what about the issue of reimbursement and bevacizumab? What's happening right now in the community? And to what extent, if any, is this being affected by the lack of FDA approval on breast cancer in terms of being able to get it paid for?
It's a very heterogeneous situation right now in terms of reimbursement. In general, the FDA decision not to reimburse it has made a major impact. Some data I saw recently from a marketing survey was that about only a third of first-line metastatic breast cancer patients have received bevacizumab, and the majority of those are in academic centers rather than in community-based practices. So we have seen a number of private insurers decline to pay for it, and Medicare in general has declined to pay for it without FDA approval. So there is clearly an issue there when it comes to that.
I'm curious how, again, in your clinical practice, both in patients on study and not on study, where are we right now in understanding safety and tolerability issues with bevacizumab? Anything new that's developed there of any concerns to you? What are you seeing in your practice?
Well, I don't think there's a lot new, notwithstanding the Excalibur data, which had been presented a few months before as well. I think one of the questions we have with the bevacizumab is the negative result in the capecitabine trial a function of the prior therapy that the patients had had, because they'd all had anthracyclines and taxanes, or is it a result of the particular combination of chemotherapy, paclitaxel versus capecitabine? Or is it an artifact, if you will, of chance or something like that? And in fairness, I don't think we know the answer, but I've been impressed that it certainly seems to work better in the first-line setting. And I would echo some of the sentiments from my colleagues here that that has influenced me to offer it more frequently as part of a first-line treatment program, since it seemed at least to work less well in the more refractory patient population. Whether that's the actual explanation, we're not sure. I tend to use paclitaxel plus bevacizumab. Most commonly, our own institution has had clinical trials work with vinorelbine plus bevacizumab, so we feel comfortable using that as well. I have not used it with other taxanes.
Skip, what about the issue of continuation of bevacizumab on disease progression? As I mentioned earlier, there was some provocative data presented in colon cancer out of a tumor registry that's now sparked a randomized trial. We've had this debate with trastuzumab, it seems like forever. I want to get Dennis's take on it. First of all, is there going to be a trial like IBET in breast cancer trying to look at that issue? And second of all, how do you approach it clinically? If you have a patient who's gotten bevacizumab and, say, paclitaxel had a really great response, maybe the paclitaxel has been stopped because of neurotoxicity, what would you do at that point if the patient progressed?
It's been a tough decision there. I think with regard to, you're right, we're getting into scenarios where I have more and more patients that have finished weekly paclitaxel and bevacizumab, and they're taking a maintenance bevacizumab approach. And if they're doing well and their disease is gradually regrowing, to continue the bevacizumab and add on a second drug has been a common thing for me to do in my practice. I don't know of a trial ongoing right now that's been planned to study that sort of strategy, but certainly it needs to be done. You know, the patients that clearly don't seem to be benefiting or are fighting the toxicity, that's been an easy decision about thinking about stopping. But in general, it's been very well tolerated.
Harold?
I actually think that's probably not a great strategy. I mean, I think we all lapsed into this behavior with trastuzumab, and perhaps that was right and perhaps it was wrong. You know, I think especially given the concerns about some of the side effects of bevacizumab and the absolute unknowns of its role and the fact that we have a negative study in the second-line setting, if you will, it seems at face value hard to think there's a huge clinical advantage for continuing. I don't know what others think about
it. Dennis, what's your take on this?
Well, I do want to respond to what Hal just said. You know, I respect the idea that we need to think about what the long-term effects might be, but I hear this as a rejoinder coming up again with trastuzumab, with bevacizumab, from the same sort of groups that use chemotherapy without blinking and saying, you know, we can accept the long-term effects, and now we're starting to see the long-term effects, and they say we can still, let's do another randomized trial and see what happens. I think these drugs are safe. I think we know the toxicity profile. I think we can give them safely, and I think they should be used. Now, the question of bevacizumab on progression, given the fact that it's not funded for the E2100 clear data that show that this improvement, it'd be hard-pressed to see that you're going to get it funded. That said, if there was a way to identify a Bev-responding patient, there seems to be little doubt to think that adding another drug later, that patient wouldn't also continue to benefit just like they have in the trastuzumab. There are no hard data for that, but that's what I would do clinically.
George, anything developing in terms of trying to predict, quote, BEV-responsive tumors?
Well, in E2100, we did collect urine and serum and tumor blocks. With regard to the urine and serum, we can say that circulating VEGF and VCAM levels do not obviously correlate with clinical benefit. We'll be having a genomic analysis being done in the fairly near future. There has already been a SNP analysis looking at VEGF and KDR SNPs that's been performed that will be presented hopefully at this year's San Antonio Breast Cancer Symposium by my colleague Brian Schneider, which, without getting into great depth, looks interesting. With regard to the duration question in the adjuvant setting, E5103 actually will be looking at a duration question for bevacizumab. In the metastatic setting, I know that Genentech is wrestling with concepts right now as to duration of therapy and treatment beyond first progression.
We want to talk about the adjuvant use of bevacizumab and the trials that are just being begun, like the ECOG study. But first, I want to turn back to Lee.
Just one other comment on what you just asked is the difference between trastuzumab and bevacizumab may be mechanistic. There's at least some thought that with bevacizumab, it may increase drug delivery. So even after progression in the first line, if there was a previous response to Bev plus chemo, there might be a rationale for Bev plus a second line chemotherapy if it could increase the response rate and progression-free survival in that setting. So I think until we know more mechanistically how it's actually working, everything is up for its hypothesis and worthy of clinical trial.
It's also interesting, George, that in colon cancer, we saw positive trials of 5-FU plus bevacizumab.
It may be that colon cancer is just simply a different cancer than breast cancer. Actually, if you look at colorectal cancer metastatic to the liver and breast cancer metastatic to the liver, they actually have different patterns of angiogenesis in the liver metastasis. So there may just be simply something different about those tumors.
What about VEGF in the two tumors?
Well, they both certainly express it in a similar range, but...
So there are data. Genentech did the analysis of all the major histologies for VEGF expression. That's where they first saw that the renal cells sort of outstripped everything else. But when you look at the rest of the malignancies, actually breast, as I recall that data, is a little more than colorectal in terms of VEGF expression. So I think the rationale is there. I'm not sure that I would look at it much differently in colorectal than I do in breast.
The group then discussed new trials in earlier stage disease using bevacizumab, a strategy also being evaluated in lung and colon cancer. Dr. Sledge began by commenting on a major new adjuvant trial being launched by the Eastern Cooperative Oncology Group.
E5103 is a three-arm trial that will take place in lymph node positive and high-risk lymph node negative, HER2-negative breast cancer patients. Interestingly, and this shows where we're changing things, part of what defines a high-risk lymph node negative ER-positive patient in this trial actually is the Oncotype assay.
Literally built into the eligibility?
Built into the eligibility and defined so in part because we're, of course, simultaneously running the TAILOR-X trial where we have patients that are being committed to receive chemotherapy in the high-risk lymph node negative group based on Oncotype.
So you let in intermediate or only high?
High. The trial randomizes patients either to a backbone of Adriamycin and Cytoxin followed by Paclitaxel, with Paclitaxel being given on a weekly basis based upon both our E2100 data and, of course, based on Joe Sprano's E1199 data, or a second arm in which patients receive chemotherapy plus bevacizumab, with the bevacizumab being given for the 6 months of chemotherapy, or the third arm in which patients receive bevacizumab out to a total of 1 year's worth of therapy.
Now the AC, is that dose dense?
That is dealer's choice, and after considerable discussion in the intergroup, and actually considerable discussion with the NCI and the FDA, because this involved logistical nightmares, as you could imagine, ended up with allowing it as a dealer's choice as to whether or not one received dose dense or not. The primary endpoint of this trial will be disease-free survival. The trial will involve roughly 5,000 patients that will be brought in through the intergroup.
Before I ask you about dose, just to go back to Andy, how do you feel about the backbone of this study? AC can be dose dense, doesn't have to be, then weekly paclitaxel. You okay with that? Or?
Well, there is a prospective examination of dose-dense AC versus yet even another schedule, and that is the metronomic schedule developed by Bob Livingston and Julie Grelo and colleagues at the University of Washington in a separate trial.
It's a SWOG study.
I think in the bottom line is my personal bias certainly would be to give dose-dense AC, but in the spirit of answering the primary study objective, you want this trial to be as friendly and as accessible to clinicians as possible. So I think that's a wise
So you'd be okay with dose-dense AC and then weekly paclitaxel in this?
Yes.
So what about dose, George?
Well, dose is an interesting question. You know, if you look at sort of major indications for bevacizumab right now, lung cancer, colorectal cancer, breast cancer, the doses that have been used in those diseases that went into the phase 3 trials in the metastatic setting were based on very small data sets, randomized phase 2 trials in the colorectal and lung cancer setting, and a phase 2 trial non-randomized in the breast cancer setting. So those data sets are very weak and don't give us any real sense as to what the appropriate dose is. Having said that, in the phase 1 setting, if one looks at how much bevacizumab it takes to suck up all of the circulating VEGF that one can measure, the answer is it's a very low dose of bevacizumab. It's probably about a mg per kg rather than 5 or 10 mgs per kg. I'd say from a biologic standpoint, we don't have any really good sense how much bevacizumab is required to have a biologic effect. I'm not at all surprised by the lung cancer data that suggests that a lower dose may be equivalent to a higher dose.
How?
There's a trial in breast cancer that mirrors that study, right? In Europe, isn't they? It's not AVAIL, but it's like Avado or
Avado,
something.
Avado, yes.
So there will be similar data within, I don't know what time period, but a year or two, I would imagine, for...
We were talking about the proposed mechanism of actions of bevacizumab, Peter. I'm curious how you think or what your speculations might be about Bev in the adjuvant setting as opposed to metastatic disease. Any guesses about how that might play out?
Well, it's one of those places where there might be a discordance. And that is, we don't really know for the micrometastatic disease whether or not neovasculature is important. And so it might well be that for the majority of micrometastatic disease, you might have an impact, for instance, in the development during the time when you were giving bevacizumab of some of the very early relapses, but overall have very little impact. And so I wouldn't be surprised if this was a trial that actually had, in the adjuvant setting, that bevacizumab might not be that powerful an agent.
Dennis, I'm curious about your thoughts of that. We have the big monster in the closet ready to come out, hopefully in the next couple of years, which is the NSABP-C08 colon trial that entered 2,600 people with adjuvant bevacizumab question. We'll see when that's going to report. Any speculations about how Bev's going to play out in the adjuvant setting?
I mean, if past behavior predicts future behavior, you would think it's going to fare well in the early setting. And I think George's experiment running in ECOG and through the intergroup, both the late study and then the early study, the drug differences notwithstanding, I think really the stage of the disease made a big difference, and I would look for the drug to have a real impact when it's used up front. Our problem remains, how do we identify the real benefiting group? And that could get diluted out in a trial like that. That's the only downside of that trial.
I'm curious, Skip, how do you think this is going to play out in terms of accrual? Again, the NSABP-COA trial, people loved it. They were just putting people on it as quickly as possible. How do you think the ECOG study is going to be received?
I think it'll accrue well. So clearly, the colon trials in the adjuvant setting have gone gangbusters, you know, for the most part with things that have been out there. So I do think it's a different population, different mentality, and not the abundance of new agents in the adjuvant setting like we've seen in breast cancer. But I think it'll be fine. There's a lot of preferences out there about dose and schedule of what you're going to give. So leaving it a little more standard probably works out better.
Lee, I think the dynamic that happened with the COA trial was that docs were looking at the residual risk of relapse after they gave their conventional therapy, and then higher risk patients, it wasn't too encouraging, looking for something that they could, you know, at least offer to their patient that might be an improvement. Do you think that's the way people are going to look at this ECOG study?
Well, I think there was a tremendous amount of enthusiasm for bevacizumab based on the initial IFL data. And as often happens with new drugs, they do get tempered over time. There was a little bit less from the colon cancer perspective from ASCO this year based on the ZELOX trial that showed that the benefit of bevacizumab when added to perhaps the optimal chemotherapy, in other words, a ZELOX or FOLFOX or Combat Bolus infusional 5-FU, as a backbone with chemotherapy had a more modest effect. So I don't think we know the answer to that yet. But I think that there's still, in breast cancer based on E2100, there's a lot of enthusiasm to improve the outcome. So I think it'll accrue.
What about the neoadjuvant setting, Melody? We have the NSABP neoadjuvant B40 study out there looking at different types of chemotherapy with and without bevacizumab. What are your thoughts about that study? How are people responding to it? And any other trial concepts you'd like to see developed for bevacizumab and breast cancer?
I think the B40 study is just exactly where we ought to be going in terms of research, because the basic idea is looking at markers of sensitivity. It's not a chemo A versus chemo B. If I could ask George two things. One, how long is the NCI funding follow-up in that trial? And two, your reaction to this recent paper on accelerating the infusion rate of Bev.
For the latter question first, I don't see that it would be any particular issue or problem. But with regard to duration of funding, it's a standard adjuvant trial, so it'll certainly have follow-up. I think the current ECOG standard is 15 years.
Joyce, any creative ideas going through U.S. Oncology in terms of bevacizumab? Frankie was talking about neoadjuvant therapy. Anything else going on that you're interested in?
To me, the big question is this issue, do we need to continue bevacizumab to get the optimal benefit from the drug? And I guess the Ribbon 3, as George says, is being discussed. I think we'll hope to participate in that. To me, that's really the key issue, aside from, you know, identifying which patients will actually benefit. Most patients have benefited in my practice. The very indolent lobulars don't seem to. That's very just clinically. So there may be some clinical parameters we can sort out. I think getting this drug into the early disease as quickly as possible, which is happening in the intergroup, is the key, I think, in the B40.
George, was Kathy's presentation on the original capecitabine's loaded trial, I mean, I'm sure it was broken down ERPR status. Was there a trend there?
It was not.
But there was not.
It was not broken down.
Oh, it was not broken down. Okay. I was just looking back at that data. That's just incredible. And just knowing what's going on out there right now with capecitabine and other VEGF inhibitors targeting triple negatives. I mean, I guess we'll get a confirmation fairly soon. But there's several people that have picked that strategy to go.
Yeah. I guess it's worth pointing out, you know, the 2119 trial, the single agent capecitabine in that trial, in an independent review analysis, had a 9% response rate. Now, that's in contrast to the FDA approval data of, 25-26% in a similar population. So I think there's just a lot of assumptions we make in doing these trials that just don't play out when we actually run the trial.